deep in the farthest recesses of the most distant jungle lies a city. A city populated by the most mysterious, terrifying, and downright grotesque denizens ever seen by mortal eye. Here, in the darkened corners of this cavernous locale, sits an ordinary, average brick building with an innocuous, ordinary, average blinking neon sign which reads, On Air. It is here where each week, Seth Breedlove and Mark Matzke convene to discuss the greatest mysteries the world has ever known. Now, strap on your hiking boots, grab your trusty walking stick, and don't forget your machete as we begin our journey through Monsteropolis.
This is Monsteropolis, a show about monsters, legends, and anomalies. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal, Mark Metzke.
Merry Christmas. Season's greetings.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. This is a... So the way we're releasing this is coming out on Christmas Eve, and we are going to put out episode... this is the only episode for this week. So this is your Christmas gift from us. And it's a very seasonal, Christmassy themed episode. We're going to be talking about, ghosts and ghouls and goblins and superstitions, Christmassy superstitions, yes, and all kinds of fun stuff. So,
and no returns, none.
and we're also going to read a Christmas story, which we've spontaneously just decided we're going to do. So, this is our Christmas gift to you guys. If you're tuning in, thanks so much for listening and thanks for sticking with us through 10 episodes. This is the 10 episode anniversary of Monsteropolis. If you're listening and you like the show, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and eventually Instagram when I figure out what our password is.
Where it is. And we are... We're on the air, correct?
Yes.
In Wadsworth?
97.1 FM. I may have forgotten to mention that in the last episode. 97.1 FM in here in Wadsworth. So if you're listening to this episode on Wadsworth Community Radio, you're listening after it already aired. You're listening after Christmas has already happened.
Yeah.
So happy belated Christmas. Merry belated Christmas from us. This week, so you suggested the show. This is Yuletide Haunts.
Yuletide Haunts.
We're going to title this episode.
Yes. Well, you know, okay, there's that song, It's the Most Wonderful Time of the Year.
Yeah, I was going to say Scary Ghost Stories.
Yeah. And for a long time, I really had no idea what Andy Williams was talking about. Because I thought, well, that's Halloween. That's not Christmas. But as it turns out, there is a grand tradition of scary ghost stories on Christmas Eve. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight is the history of that and some of the prominent authors and why ghost stories on Christmas.
And I think you have to go all the way back to medieval times to really find the answers to that. And apparently, well, I don't even know if you have an answer. You might have an answer. All I could find is that they started telling stories relating to the macabre back around the medieval times, and the theories I read about it were mostly that it's a very dark and dreary time of the year. The year is coming to an end, so it's a time. It's also a time where apparently they feel the veil between this life and the next is at its absolute thinnest, and specifically Christmas Eve is where the veil between our world and the afterlife is at its thinnest. I could not find a reason for that belief, but that's what I found. For the ancients, death was a central theme in December. It was the perfect time for ghosts, and December 24th was considered the time when the veil was thinnest and the dead could easily pass from their world into ours. The English Victorians used to tell ghost stories around the hearth in the cold winter months and around Christmas as a way to pass the time. Ghost stories were immensely popular in the mid-19th century and onward, but apparently long before that as well.
Yeah, and I think it has a lot to do with the winter solstice. I mean, in many ways, it's a more natural Halloween than Halloween.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right. I mean, it has a lot to do with those things. The night is long. There's this urge to have people closest to you get together. And of course, in pre-TV and screen world, you would tell stories and try to top each other. You know, you think that was a scary story. Well, I'm going to tell a scarier one. And I think that it's, you know, the other thing that I read that I thought was interesting too is that at a time where sentimentality seems to rise to the surface around Christmas, you're thinking about those who aren't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And maybe if it is true that it's a thinner, you know, veneer between realities, that your loved one might be closer to you during that time, and you're just thinking about them and hoping that there's some sort of connection that's still there.
Yeah, I had always considered the winter the scariest sort of time of the year, and that goes back to being a kid and playing outside all the time. My brother and I were never inside ever. It didn't matter like what season of the year. If it was midwinter and there was 6 feet of snow on the ground, we were going to be back in the woods. So there, it gets dark exceptionally early.
And quickly too.
Yeah. And it's always, when there is snow on the ground, it's unnervingly quiet outside. It's unbelievably quiet. And you're right. Like, there's something about winter that's almost more of a natural Halloween time than Halloween itself. Because in Halloween, there's still life. There's still people running around. There's wind. And there's all these things that are kind of scary. But they're not as scary as complete, still, quiet, snow falling, you know, and you roll over in bed and there's a ghost standing next to it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that makes me think of sort of the visual look of Bray Road Beast, mm-hmm. you know, where there wasn't really any growth on the trees yet. And many people have commented on that. You know, was that a conscious choice? And it really wasn't. We kind of expected there to be more in the way of you know, budding trees and so forth. But
that was the idea, was that Bray Road Beast would be filmed when life was coming in. Mm-hmm. into everything, because there was like something about the growth and like the changing, and like I associate that sort of like adaptation with like werewolves, and instead we had this like completely dead sort of environment. Yeah. Which worked really well.
It did.
But same with Mothman. The Mothman in Point Pleasant mm-hmm. has the same a very similar visual style, and we have snow and that midwinter Christmas lights and all that. And in fact, like that, we might consider that next year is talking about the Silver Bridge and the Mothman story. We're going to get into it a little bit in the next episode with Indrid Cold probably, but there's something about winter that's a little creepy.
Yeah. I guess I think of Bray Road Beast as kind of a winter movie, even though it was shot in April, largely because we were chased out of town by a winter storm.
Yeah.
And we had to try and get out of there.
An ice storm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go, obviously one of the reasons I think people in the present day probably think about ghost stories and Christmas is because of A Christmas Carol. And we referenced this in the last episode, but I was really intrigued by the fact that so it seems like in the 19th century, there was almost not a ban on Christmas, but
it had begun as a ban in Great Britain.
Well, what's the guy's name?
Cromwell. Yeah.
Had essentially like started to sort of put the kibosh on Christmas because of something to do with like the culture of excess and all this mm-hmm. other nonsense. And they had essentially stopped celebrating Christmas. That changes in the 1800s around the same time that Dickens writes A Christmas Carol. And the two seem to be at least somehow connected, beyond the fact that it does seem like businesses and things like that had latched on to the holiday because they could, you know, commercialize it. But there also seems to be that maybe A Christmas Carol, the story, had helped sort of propel the holiday back into the public eye to an extent as well.
Yeah, that's very much the case. I mean, that was really interesting to review too, and getting ready for today. You know, the thing that I looked at said in 1863, Christmas was fading. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was on the ropes. And and A Christmas Carol helped resuscitate it. Not only the public celebration of it, but sort of the general feeling. I mean, what Dickens was really concerned with was helping the poor. And that comes through loud and clear in his story. And that has become kind of a major feature of it culturally, even to this day. You know, even people who aren't necessarily looking at Christmas as a religious celebration, there's a sense that they're looking for people to help. And that's very much a Dickensian, you know, concern of his.
And that story terrified me as a kid. So this is my only, until A Muppet's Christmas Carol came out, my only familiarity with it was Mickey's Christmas Carol.
Oh, yeah.
And that terrified me. There's a scene in that where Pete takes someone to hell, and there's all kinds of, like, it. Something about that story, though, really creeps me out, because you've actually got like five very specific, one of them is fine, but the rest of them are pretty creepy ghosts. Like Jacob and Marley are creepy sort of ghosts to begin with, and then you get into, when you finally get to the Ghost of Christmas Future, it's terrifying, because like he's essentially like the Grim Reaper. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting that the story that helped elevate Christmas back to some level of popularity is what is really a pretty creepy story. Like, it really is a creepy, it's got the warm, you know, Christmassy vibes, and it's got a good message and everything, but the ghosts themselves are actually pretty scary.
Yeah. Yeah. That's funny you mentioned Muppet Christmas Carol, because that's not a bad retelling.
No.
It's pretty faithful to the source material.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, my favorite, is that your favorite Christmas Carol adaptation?
No, it's the Mickey.
Is it really?
It's the Mickey one. Mostly because, like, that's what I grew up. On Thanksgiving, we would watch Mickey's Christmas Carol and the Disney Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So, like, those have always been two. I connect those with Christmas, even Sleepy Hollow, which most people connect with Halloween. Mm-hmm. I connect both of those with, well, obviously Christmas Carol you would, but even Sleepy Hollow I do. But that's my favorite.
I was just wondering, my favorite is the George C. Scott. Have you seen that one?
No. It's terrifying. It's Patton.
Well, yeah. I mean, he brings that to the Scrooge role pretty well.
I guess he would be good at that.
Yeah, that's a good one. I think that was made for TV, but... But anyway, that was pretty, the effects in that were quite good.
Yeah.
I remember. I haven't seen many of the modern day adaptions of it.
I skipped them all.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen it. So, like, you know the story. It's kind of like Spider-Man's origin. So the BBC kept this Christmas ghost storytelling tradition going, and it seems like that's still pretty big in England. Like, that they still love telling their scary stories at Christmas. Yeah. I found and you might already know this, but there's like there's a couple of BBC specials I found on YouTube where it's just Christopher Lee reading ghost stories.
Yes.
For like an hour.
That's awesome.
Have you watched them?
I haven't watched them all the way, but
yeah,
I've got it queued up.
I might have to check them out. But do you, like, why? So is that your sort of, like, that's what you're subscribing to, is just that, like, the seasonally and you know, like, it just invites that kind of, like, creepiness?
Yeah, I think it's, well, I mean, the series that you mentioned really got off the ground in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. It was the BBC's A Ghost Story for Christmas, and it was revived in 2005. And it took stories from British writers that... you know, were ghost stories, and by that time, a lot of them, even turn-of-the-century writers, were writing ghost stories specifically incorporating some portion of Christmas. So not only was it a ghost story, like just self-contained spooky tale, but it was something in it had to do with Christmas Eve or that night. So it was very specifically themed. And, you know, this goes back to some of the, well, Charles Dickens, obviously, but there's other authors as well, like E.F. Benson, who wrote tons. All these authors are prolific, but
and a lot of them were women.
Correct.
A lot of them were women writing under pen names, is what I found online.
Yeah,
which I thought was interesting.
Yep. So E.F. Benson had Between the Lights, which is set on Christmas Eve. Algernon Blackwood has the kit bag. And did you... You have to read The Kit Bag by Algernon
Blackwood. Is that the one with the head in the severed head in the bag?
It's not a... No.
Okay.
No.
Because there is one where that's a thing.
Yeah.
I didn't read it.
This one, it's a legal assistant who's getting ready to go to the Alps for Christmas, and he gets sent the wrong bag to his house.
Mm-hmm.
And he's packing it for his trip, and something happens with the bag.
What happens?
Well, you have to read it.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert. Now I want to know, is the bag previously owned by the Yeti, and it's...
No.
Okay.
But it is previously owned by a...
Serial killer.
By a criminal.
Okay.
Yeah. So J.H. Riddell, who sound, like you said, it actually was Charlotte Riddell, J.H. Riddell's wife, wrote a story called A Strange Christmas Game, and she was extremely popular, a very influential Victorian writer. I don't know if people knew J.H. was a she or not, but at this point, you know, it's well known. A.M. Burridge, who you're going to hear from in a little bit, who wrote a story called Smee, set on a Christmas Eve. And then there is an author called M.R. James, who, you know, I resonated with him because he was a son of a clergyman, and he went off to become a clergyman and a scholar himself. And for fun, he wrote ghost stories. And some of those were turned into stories that were televised in the BBC revival in 2005. And he has this one that I read, and these stories aren't gory. They're not like, blood and guts. But the first story is to give you a sense is a guy, an antiquarian collector who buys a book by a saint who the saint's gift was casting out demons. And sort of the whole thing behind the story is when a saint casts out demons, where do the demons go? And so...
Did they go into the bag? That bag from that other story?
It's a cross. One of the original crossover events, right?
All right.
So there's this whole body of work, you know, to fill the tradition. And the thing that's so cool too, and you'll like this because it's Washington Irving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he has in his book, The Sketchbook of Jeffrey Cran from 1819, one of the short stories in there is called Old Christmas. And it basically describes in an American setting the tradition of telling ghost stories on Christmas Eve, right down to the, you know, everybody gathers by the fire and they're knocking back a few and starting to tell ghost stories together. And it's the Sketchbook of Jeffrey Cran is the same source of the story Sleepy Hollow, Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Comes out of that same collection.
And a lot of people consider Legend of Sleepy Hollow a Christmassy story. I don't know why that is. But I saw the other day that they're selling an outdoor Christmas display that is the Headless Horseman. It's a Christmas light up display, but it's the Headless Horseman. And I thought, well, maybe I'm not the only one that connects Legend of Sleepy Hollow with Christmas. Like maybe other people do as well.
Yeah. And it could be, I mean, because of its proximity in the work.
Mm-hmm.
To the old Christmas story.
Yeah.
And I mean, is there like snow and ice and stuff as part of the story?
I don't think
not?
There is. See, I've got a ton of books sitting next to you on those shelves about Sleepy Hollow and about the Legend of Sleepy Hollow that I need to get to soon.
That
and
deserves its own show.
We'll do our own show about it.
Yeah.
Believe me, we'll do our own show about it. We might go to Sleepy Hollow together and do some sort of live show.
Yeah.
Do you want to read this now and then sort of wrap up? Because I think we want to.
Yeah.
Do you want to read it to wrap up? How do you want to do it?
We'll read it and then wrap up.
Okay.
How's
we're
that?
Gonna we're gonna read a story, a Christmas story, one of these stories, the one that Mark referenced, Smee, by A.M. Burridge. Is that right? I'm gonna read as much as I can handle before I get sick of my own voice, and then I'm just gonna hand you. We're gonna read this off my phone, so no guarantees on how. how this is going to go, but this is our idea to actually give you a sort of an idea of how these stories are. We're going to read one for you. I'm just going to take a little bit of time, but this is our Christmas gift to you. Hopefully you're enjoying your Christmas Eve listening to this in front of a warm fire with your Christmas tree lit up. Okay, here we go. I should read it in a British accent. I'm not. I am immediately noticing I don't know how to... How do you even say that first word right there?
Deprecatory.
I should just let you do
deprecatory.
This.
Deprecatory.
I'm going to read this till I hit another word like that, and then I'm out.
Just use the British accent. It'll sound...
No, right. Said Jackson. No, said Jackson with a deprecatory smile. I'm sorry. I don't want to upset your game. I shan't be doing that because you'll have plenty without me. But I'm not playing any game of hide and seek. It was Christmas Eve, and we were a party of 14 with just the proper leavening of youth. We had dined well. It was the season for childish games, and we were all in the mood for playing them. All, that is, except Jackson. When somebody suggested hide and seek, there was rapturous and almost unanimous approval. He was the one dissentient voice. It was not like Jackson to spoil sport or refuse to do so, as others wanted. Somebody asked him if he were feeling seedy. No, he answered. I feel perfectly fit, thanks. But he added with a smile which softened without retracting the flat refusal. I'm not playing hide and seek. Why not? Someone asked. He hesitated for a moment before replying. I sometimes go and stay at a house where a girl was killed. She was playing hide and seek in the dark. She didn't know the house very well. There was a door that led to the servant's staircase. When she was chased, she thought the door led to a bedroom. She opened the door and jumped, and landed at the bottom of the stairs. She broke her neck, of course. We all looked serious. Mrs. Fernley said, "How terrible! And were you there when it happened?" Jackson shook his head sadly. "No," he said, "but I was there when something else happened. Something worse." "What could be worse than that?" "This was," said Jackson. He hesitated for a moment, then he said, "I wonder if any of you have ever played a game called Smee. It's much better than hide and seek. The name comes from It's Me, of course. Perhaps you'd like to play it instead of hide and seek. Let me tell you the rules of the game. Every player is given a sheet of paper. All the sheets, except one, are blank. On the last sheet of paper is written Smee. Nobody knows who Smee is except Smee himself, or herself. You turn out the lights and Smee goes quietly out of the room and hides. After a time, the others go off to search for Smee, but of course they don't know who they are looking for. When one player meets another, he challenges him by saying Smee. The other player answers Smee and they continue searching. But the real Smee doesn't answer when someone challenges. The second player stays quietly beside him. Presently, they will be discovered by a third player. He will challenge and receive no answer, and he will join the first two. This goes on until all the players are in the same place. The last one to find Smee has to pay a forfeit. It's a good, noisy, amusing game. In a big house, it often takes a long time for everyone to find Smee. Perhaps you'd like to try. I'll happily pay my forfeit and sit here by the fire while you play. It sounds a good game, I remarked. Have you played it too, Jackson? Yes, he answered. I played it in the house that I was telling you about. And she was there? The girl who broke... No, no, said someone else. He told us he wasn't there when she broke her neck. Jackson thought for a moment. I don't know if she was there or not. I'm afraid she was. I know that there were 13 of us playing the game and there were only 12 people in the house, and I don't know the dead girl's name. When I heard that whispered name in the dark, it didn't worry me. But I tell you, I'm never going to play that game again. It made me quite nervous for a long time. I prefer to pay my forfeit at once. We all stared at him. His words did not make sense at all.
Tim Vaus was the kindest man in the world. He smiled at us all. This sounds like an interesting story, he said. Come on, Jackson. You can tell it to us instead of paying a forfeit. Very well, said Jackson. And here is his story. Have you met the Sangstons? They're cousins of mine, and they live in Surrey. 5 years ago, they invited me to go and spend Christmas with them. It was an old house with lots of unnecessary passages and staircases. A stranger could get lost in it quite easily. Well, I went down for that Christmas. Violet Sangston promised me that I knew most of the other guests. Unfortunately, I couldn't get away from my job until Christmas Eve. All the other guests had arrived there the previous day. I was the last to arrive, and I was only just in time for dinner. I said hello to everyone I knew, and Violet Sangston introduced me to the people I didn't know. Then it was time to go into dinner. That is perhaps why I didn't hear the name of a tall, dark-haired, handsome girl whom I hadn't met before. Everyone was in a rather hurry, and I'm always bad at catching people's names. She looked cold and clever. She didn't look at all friendly, but she looked interesting, and I wondered who she was. I didn't ask because I was sure that someone would speak to her by name during the meal. Unluckily, however, I was a long way from her at table. I was sitting next to Mrs. Gorman, and as usual, Mrs. Gorman was being very bright and amusing. Her conversation is always worth listening to, and I completely forgot to ask the name of the dark, proud girl. There were 12 of us, including the Sangstons themselves. We were all young, or trying to be young. Jack and Violet Sangston were the oldest, and their 17-year-old son Reggie was the youngest. It was Reggie who suggested Smee when the talk turned to games. He told us the rules of the game, just as I've described them to you. Jack Sangston warned us all, "If you're going to play games in the dark," he said, "please be careful of the back stairs on the first floor. A door leads to them, and I've often thought about taking the door off. In the dark, a stranger to the house could think they were walking into a room. A girl really did break her neck on those stairs." I asked how it happened. "It was about 10 years ago, before we came here. There was a party, and they were playing hide-and-seek. This girl was looking for somewhere to hide. She heard somebody coming and ran along the passage to get away. She opened the door, thinking it led to a bedroom. She planned to hide in there until the seeker had gone. Unfortunately, it was the door that led to the back stairs. She fell straight down to the bottom of the stairs. She was dead when they picked her up." We all promised to be careful. Mrs. Gorman even made a little joke about living to be 90. You see, none of us had known the poor girl, and we did not want to feel sad on Christmas Eve. Well, we all started the game immediately after dinner. Young Reggie Sangston went round making sure all the lights were off except the ones in the servants' rooms and in the sitting room where we were. We then prepared 12 sheets of paper. 11 of them were blank, and one of them had Smee written on it. Reggie mixed them all up, then we each took one. The person who got the paper with Smee on it had to hide. I looked at mine and saw that it was blank. A moment later, all the electric lights went out. In the darkness, I heard someone moving very quietly to the door. After a minute, someone blew a whistle, and we all rushed to the door. I had no idea who was Smee. For 5 or 10 minutes, we were all rushing up and down passages and in and out of rooms, challenging each other and answering, "Smee? Smee?" After a while, the noise died down, and I guessed that someone had found Smee. After a time, I found a group of people all sitting on some narrow stairs. I challenged and received no answer, so Smee was there. I hurriedly joined the group. Presently, 2 more players arrived. Each one was hurrying to avoid being last. Jack Sangston was last and was given a forfeit. "I think we're all here now, aren't we?" he remarked. He lit a match, looked up the staircase, and began to count. 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, he said, and then laughed. "That's silly. There's one too many." The match went out, and he lit another and began to count. He got as far as 12, then he looked puzzled. "There are 13 people here," he said. "I haven't counted myself yet." "Oh, nonsense," I laughed. "You probably began with yourself, and now you want to count yourself twice." His son took out his electric torch. I gave a better light than the matches, and we all began to count. Of course, there were 12 of us. Jack laughed. "Well," he said, "I was sure I counted 13 twice." From halfway up the stairs, Violet Sangston spoke nervously. "I thought there was somebody sitting 2 steps above me. Have you moved, Captain Ransom?" The captain said that he hadn't. "But I thought there was somebody sitting between Mrs. Sangston and me." Just for a moment, there was an uncomfortable something in the air. A cold finger seemed to touch us all. For that moment, we all felt that something odd and unpleasant had just happened and was likely to happen again. Then we laughed at ourselves and at each other, and we felt normal again. There were only 12 of us, and that was that. Still laughing, we march back to the sitting room to begin again. This time, I was Smee. Violet Sangston found me while I was searching for a hiding place. That game didn't last long. Soon there were 12 people and the game was over. Violet felt cold and wanted her jacket. Her husband went up to their bedroom to fetch it. As soon as he'd gone, Reggie touched me on the arm. He was looking pale and sick. "Quick," he whispered, "I've got to talk to you. Something horrible has happened." We went into the breakfast room. "What's the matter?" I asked. "I don't know. You were Smee last time, weren't you?" Well, of course, I didn't know who Smee was. While Mother and the others ran to the west side of the house and found you, I went east. There's a deep clothes cupboard in my bedroom. It looked like a good hiding place. I thought that perhaps Smee might be there. I opened the door in the dark and somebody touched somebody's hand. "Smee?" I whispered. There was no answer. I thought I'd found Smee. Well, I don't understand it, but suddenly I had a strange cold feeling. I can't describe it, but I felt that something was wrong. So I turned on my electric torch, and there was nobody there. Now, I'm sure I touched a hand, and nobody could get out of the cupboard because I was standing in the doorway. But what do you think? "You imagine that you touched a hand," I said. He gave a short laugh. "I knew you would say that," he said. "Of course I imagined it. That's the only explanation, isn't it?" I agreed with him. I could see that he still felt shaken. Together, we returned to the sitting room for another game of Smee. The others were all ready and waiting to start again. Perhaps it was my imagination, although I'm almost sure that it was not, but I had a feeling that nobody was really enjoying the game anymore. But everyone was too polite to mention it. All the same, I had the feeling that something was wrong. All the fun had gone out of the game. Something deep inside me was trying to warn me. "Take care," it whispered. "Take care." There was some unnatural, unhealthy influence at work in the house. Why did I have this feeling? Because Jack Sangston had counted 13 people instead of 12? Because his son imagined he had touched someone's hand in an empty cupboard? I tried to laugh at myself, but I did not succeed. Well, we started again. While we were all chasing the unknown Smee, we were all as noisy as ever, but it seemed to me that most of us were just acting. We were no longer enjoying the game. At first, I stayed with the others, but for several minutes, no Smee was found. I left the main group and started searching on the first floor at the west side of the house. And there, while I was feeling my way along, I bumped into a pair of human knees. I put out my hand and touched a soft, heavy curtain. Then I knew where I was. There were tall, deep windows with window seats at the end of the passage. The curtains reached to the ground. Somebody was sitting in a corner of one of the window seats behind a curtain. "Aha," I thought, "I've caught Smee." So I pulled the curtain to one side and touched a woman's arm. It was a dark, moonless night outside. I couldn't see the woman sitting in the corner of the window seat. "Smee?" I whispered. There was no answer. When Smee is challenged, he, or she, does not answer, so I sat down beside her to wait for the others. Then I whispered, "What's your name?" And out of the darkness beside me, the whisper came, "Brenda Ford." I did not know the name, but I guessed at once who she was. I knew every girl in the house by name, except one, and that was the tall, pale, dark girl. So here she was, sitting beside me on the window seat, shut in between a heavy curtain and a window. I was beginning to enjoy the game. I wondered if she was enjoying it too. I whispered one or two rather ordinary questions to her and received no answer. Smee is a game of silence. It is a rule of the game that Smee and the person or persons who have found Smee have to keep quiet. This, of course, makes it harder for the others to find them. But there was nobody else about. I wondered, therefore, why she was insisting on silence. I spoke again and got no answer. I began to feel a little annoyed. Perhaps she's one of those cold, clever girls who have a poor opinion of men, I thought. She doesn't like me, and she's using the rules of the game as an excuse for not speaking. Well, if she doesn't like sitting here with me, I certainly don't want to sit with her. I turned away from her. I hope someone finds us soon, I thought. As I sat there, I realized that I disliked sitting beside this girl very much indeed. That was strange. The girl I had seen at dinner had seemed likable in a cold, kind sort of way. I noticed her and wanted to know more about her, but now I felt really uncomfortable beside her. The feeling of something wrong, something unnatural, was growing. I remembered touching her arm, and I trembled with horror. I wanted to jump up and run away. I prayed that someone else would come along soon. Just then, I heard light footsteps in the passage. Somebody on the other side of the curtain brushed against my knees. The curtain moved to one side, and a woman's hand touched my shoulder. "Smee," whispered a voice that I recognized at once. It was Mrs. Gorman. Of course, she received no answer. She came and sat down beside me, and at once I felt very much better. "It's Tony Jackson, isn't it?" she whispered. "Yes," I whispered back. "You're not Smee, are you?" "No, she's on my other side." She reached out across me. I heard her fingernail scratch a woman's silk dress. "Hello, Smee. How are you? Who are you?" "Oh, is it against the rules to talk?" "Never mind. Tony, we'll break the rules. Do you know, Tony, this game is beginning to annoy me a little? I hope they aren't going to play it all evening. I'd like to play a nice, quiet game all together beside a warm fire." "Me too," I agreed. "Can't you suggest something to them? There's something rather unhealthy about this particular game. I'm sure I'm being very silly, but I can't get rid of the idea that we've got an extra player. Somebody who ought not to be here at all." That was exactly how I felt, but I didn't say so. However, I felt very much better. Mrs. Gorman's arrival had chased away my fears. We sat talking. "I wonder when the others will find us," said Mrs. Gorman. After a time, we heard the sound of feet and young Reggie's voice shouting, "Hello? Hello? Is anybody there?" "Yes," I answered. "Is Mrs. Gorman with you?" "Yes." "What happened to you? You've both got forfeits. We've all been waiting for you for hours." "But you haven't found Smee yet," I complained. "You haven't, you mean? I was Smee this time." "But Smee is here with us," I cried. "Yes," agreed Mrs. Gorman. The curtain was pulled back, and we sat looking into the eye of Reggie's electric torch. I looked at Mrs. Gorman, and then on my other side, between me and the wall, was an empty place on the window seat. I stood up at once, then I sat down again. I was feeling very sick, and the world seemed to be going round and round. "There was somebody there," I insisted, "because I touched her." "So did I," said Mrs. Gorman in a trembling voice. "And I don't think anyone could leave this window seat without us knowing." Reggie gave a shaky little laugh. I remembered his unpleasant experience earlier that evening. "Someone's been playing jokes," he said. "Are you coming down?" We were not very popular when we came down to the sitting room. "I found the two of them sitting behind a curtain on a window seat," said Reggie. I went up to the tall, dark girl. "So you pretended to be Smee and then went away," I accused her. She shook her head. "Afterwards, we all played cards in the sitting room, and I was very glad." Sometime later, Jack Sangston wanted to talk to me. I could see that he was rather cross with me, and soon he told me the reason. "Tony," he said, "I suppose you are in love with Mrs. Gorman. That's your business, but please don't make love to her in my house during a game. You kept everyone waiting. It was very rude of you, and I'm ashamed of you." "But we were not alone," I protested. "There was somebody else there, somebody who was pretending to be Smee. I believe that it was that tall, dark girl, Miss Ford." She whispered her name to me. Of course, she refused to admit it afterwards. Jack Sangston stared at me. "Miss who?" he breathed. "Brenda Ford," she said. Jack put a hand on my shoulder. "Look here, Tony," he said. "I don't mind a joke, but enough is enough. We don't want to worry the ladies. Brenda Ford is the name of the girl who broke her neck on the stairs. She was playing hide-and-seek here 10 years ago.
Yeah, I can't. You wanted me to switch over and take over at one point. You're a much better reader than I am, so I was tuned in for that whole thing.
Oh, good.
Okay, so we got to wrap up because we've gone way over. Well, not way over. We've gone over.
And it's your Christmas Eve, so we don't want to.
Yeah, we don't want to monopolize it. You need to go play a game of Smee or whatever. Right. Wrap us up. Take us. What do you want to end on?
The oldest quote that I found about this tradition of ghost stories on Christmas Eve or wintertime comes from 1589, and it's an author named Christopher Marlowe, and this is the quote. "Now I remember these old women's words, who in my wealth would tell me winter's tales and speak of spirits and ghosts that glide by night."
Merry Christmas, Monsteropolis listeners.
Monsteropolis is proudly presented on Wadsworth Community Radio 97.1 FM or streaming live at wadsworthcommunityradio.com and is proudly underwritten by Thurber's Jewelers on the Square in downtown Wadsworth.